Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading news from the San Angelo Standard Times newspaper, as well as the sanangelolive.com website. From the Standard Times, 9 arrested in San Angelo area for suspect crimes against children, from staff reports published March 1st. A multitask agency task operation led to the arrest of 9 people for crimes against children in the San Angelo area. The two-day operation included the Department of Homeland Security Office in San Angelo, as well as the Texas Department of Public Safety, FBI, U.S. Air Force, and the Cyber Crimes Unit of the Abilene Police Department. They targeted suspects seeking to engage in sexual contact with minors in the San Angelo area, according to a media release. Tech Regents approved Phase 2 of ASU auditorium renovations by Mateo Rosiles, Lubbock Avalanche Jr. During their meeting Thursday, the Board of Regents for the Texas Tech University System approved several items brought forward by Angelo State University leaders, the biggest being approving Phase 2 of the Elta Joyce Murphy Auditorium renovation project. Phase 2 would produce design development of the project, a statement of probable cost, and a project schedule, among other needed construction documents, said Billy Breedlove, Vice Chancellor for Facilities Planning and Construction for the Tech System. According to the Vice Chancellor's presentation, the project's goal is to address life, safety, and accessibility issues for the auditorium space and additional rooms. The board unanimously authorized $513,307,000 expenditure for Phase 2. With the authorization, the total for the project is $708,903, with an anticipated total budget of $6 million. Among the other items that were authorized with the full consent of the board was the promotion of 6 associate professors to the rank of professor. A dozen assistant professors were also promoted to associate professors while also granting them tenure. ASU was also authorized to execute a strategic enrollment plan with Campus Works to ensure long-term enrollment success and physical health, according to the agenda book. The regents unanimously approved the $139,820 contract that will also pay for travel costs. After Thursday's executive session, the board authorized President Ronnie Hawkins of ASU to execute a contract with the city of San Angelo for the future rodeo team coming to ASU. My father is fine. San Angelo man's family coping with brain cancer diagnosis, by John Tufts, published February 23rd. My father is fine. Perfectly fine, he says. Fantastic. Those are his words. The answer he gives after I ask, hesitantly, how are you feeling, Dad? As he sits in a hospital bed at home in his living room, watching television, dying slowly from a brain tumor. It was a stupid question, I suppose. Made sadder because I'm paid to ask smart questions. But I couldn't think of anything smart, or deep, or funny. All I could do was sit next to my father as he watched another episode of Wheel of Fortune. Oh, you dummy, he says, laughing at the contestant in the white button-up shirt and large glasses who guessed the puzzle wrong. Yeah, what an idiot, I say, staring at the screen. Hey, you need anything, Dad? No, I'm fine. I wasn't going to write anything. I didn't think I was capable of writing at all. But here I am, writing. It's what I do, professionally as a journalist. And sometimes when I take the occasional half-assed stab at fiction. So I'll start with what I know. A story about someone else's life. It began with a fall. Dad stumbled in the bathroom. It happened on the second floor of my parents' apartment in San Angelo. He fell and hit his head. Mom was downstairs and heard the sound of his body crashing into the shelves by the toilet. She raced to the bathroom and found him unable to sit up. Dad tried to explain that he was fine. It was just a little fall, but his words were slow and slurred. Then Mom saw the side of his face. It was drooping. She called an ambulance, worried her husband of 49 years had suffered a massive stroke. He hadn't, but we wouldn't know the reason for another 6 hours. Well, I had quite the day. He managed at last to tell me over the phone from his hospital room at Shannon Medical Center. I listened to him talk about what had happened earlier that morning. The fall. The trip to the hospital. But he was struggling with his words. At one point, he said, "The Serenity Men, you know, Serenity. They came, and they tried picking me up to bring me here." Mom clarified that an EMS crew arrived, placed him on a stretcher, and carried him down the stairs to a waiting ambulance. Dad couldn't quite articulate the who, the what, or the where. But the why came after an X-ray. "He has a brain tumor," his neurologist said, pointing to a dark blob on one side of the chart. "A big one. A glioblastoma. It's what he, you know, the governor had. No, not the governor. He was in New Mexico? No, Arizona," Dad said. In 2017, Arizona Senator John McCain was diagnosed with glioblastoma. That's what Dad was trying to tell me. And he would know. He's an avid follower of politics. Always has been. Watching CNN, MSNBC, the news with Shepard Smith, PBS NewsHour, and 60 Minutes. That was his life. Dad can name every power player in Washington. Every person who had run for president in the past decade. He loved that stuff. Ate it up. And yet, McCain's name somehow escaped him. That and the fact that McCain had been a senator, not a governor. It was the tumor. Like ocean waves to a sandcastle, it was taking little bits of him, piece by piece, grain by grain, fact by fact, smoothing over once carefully constructed details and leaving only faint traces of what had been there before. What my father could remember about McCain's glioblastoma was this. It was fatal. After the diagnosis, McCain survived a little more than a year. A neurologist said my father wouldn't live nearly that long. We were told the tumor is in Dad's parietal lobe, an area of the brain dedicated to processing sensory information, touch, taste, hearing, smell, and sight. Among other functions, the parietal lobe handles spatial awareness, allowing the body to maintain its balance. Dad can no longer get around without a walker or a wheelchair. To make matters worse, the tumor will damage his cognition, speech, and ability to write. Dad enjoyed crafting and telling stories in his spare time, so that last one especially hurts. "The tumor is growing at a small but alarming rate," doctors said. "A centimeter or two per day. It would double in size after roughly 7 weeks. It has tendrils, like a jellyfish, that are spreading to other parts of his brain. An MRI determined the tumor was invading his occipital lobe, which is responsible for vision. At the time of this writing, Dad can no longer read or see the buttons on his TV remote control. The survival rate for glioblastoma is about 6 to 12 months, under ideal circumstances. Without treatment, the doctor gave him between 2 weeks and 2 months to live. That was a month ago. I remember the phone call with his neurologist. Mom was in the hospital room, trying not to cry. So was my sister, Sarah Marie. She had canceled everything and driven 4 hours from Austin to be here. All I could do was listen in on a speakerphone, sitting in a spacious conference room at the Indianapolis Star, more than 1,000 miles away. A team of doctors spelled out his options. All of them were bad. Option one, he could have surgery, but there was no guarantee it would remove every last bit of cancer in his head. Remember those tendrils? They would grow back. We were warned he could die on the operating table. We were told there was a strong possibility the surgery could cost him his vision, his hearing, and his ability to speak. All in all, if everything went perfect, and that was a big if, an operation would buy him maybe an extra 2 to 4 months of life. Then the cancer would return. There was a risk of him becoming a vegetable and staying in a nursing care facility until the day he died. That was option one, and it was the more optimistic choice out of the others. Option two was to have a biopsy and then undergo chemotherapy. The costs and benefits are tedious and too stupid to list here. Option three was to do nothing, to leave the hospital, to allow nature to take its course. A team of hospice nurses would see to his needs until the end came. And that, by the way, was the one certainty we were given. His death was imminent. Its timing came down to a murky window of weeks or months, but not years. A Hobson's choice between my father dying either in a facility or dying at home. And I want to pause here for just a moment to say how extraordinarily well he took hearing the news. If you know my dad, really know James Clifton Tufts, Jim to his friends, Jimmy when his mother was alive, Jamesy to my own mother when she's feeling playful, then you've witnessed how perpetually calm, uncommonly nice, and almost zen-like his demeanor can be. I'm his son. I've known him for more than 40 years, and I can count the number of times he lost his temper. I don't even need all the fingers on my left hand to do it. He screamed once in California, late at night, when the bathroom toilet broke and sewage was spilling into the house. And I don't think that sort of outburst counts. Everyone should get a pass on plumbing disasters. I myself have uttered more swear words in the past effing month, just in thinking about his death, than my own father has probably cussed in his entire life. He's the kind of man who, if he got hit by a freight train and survived, would tell you, "I'm fine, perfectly fine, fantastic." He would say that calmly, even if his legs and arms had been amputated by a 3,000-ton locomotive. He'd go so far as to ask in all seriousness if the train was okay. "Just find my arms and legs. We can go and apologize to the nice railroad people later." Do you know my dad? Tell me that's not him. And that was the same man in the hospital gown last month, connected to all sorts of wires and tubes monitoring his vital organs, as a doctor in a white lab coat stood there and gave him a death sentence. He was quiet for a moment. The only noise in the room came from the beeping of the instruments, keeping watchful track of his heartbeat and blood pressure, and the sound of my mother sniffling. "Oh, well, I want to do whatever's best for Mary and the kids," he said at last. He was so calm. Not a single outburst, not even a tear. Perhaps he was in shock. I know the rest of us were. Mom was choking back emotion. Sarah Marie seemed to be holding it together. And I had my phone on mute, so no one could hear what I was saying. Alone, in a workplace conference room, a time zone away in Indiana. The doctor went over his three options: surgery, chemotherapy, or hospice. It took a while to explain. It took even longer to decide what he wanted to do. The tumor was nearly a month old at this point, and it was already stripping him of his ability to respond using clear sentences. He asked what each of us thought. And then when it came to my turn, he asked my opinion on going into hospice. And so I told him this. Dad, if that's what you want to do, to leave the hospital, when you go home, the nurses will make you as comfortable as possible. Every day you wake up, Mom will be right there by your side. You'll have your cat. You'll have your TV. You'll get to watch your favorite Westerns. You'll get to watch them until the very end. You have to know something about my dad. He grew up on a steady diet of black and white television and was always partial to shows with cowboys and sheriffs. Whenever I visited, he was usually seated in his recliner, enjoying episodes of Stagecoach and Wyatt Earp. Actors like Hugh O'Brien and Morgan Woodward portrayed characters who solved all their problems with their fists or their guns. I'd sit on the couch with him, watching Charles Bronson. Yes, that Charles Bronson, donned in cowboy duds, as he took care of bank robbers and horse thieves using his six-shooters and a few choice words. The fictional characters my father admired were all tough, quiet men, driven by their moral compass to do the right thing under whatever circumstances they found themselves in. They didn't curse or shout. They didn't get agitated or show fear. They stepped outside with their spurs on, walking defiantly through a dusty street at high noon, guns ready, knowing full well any moment could be their last. They fought on. Most of the time, they won. In the end, my father chose to go home and watch his Westerns. I hugged him for the last time 2 weeks ago. It was a short trip, 3 days in San Angelo. I flew from Indianapolis to Austin, then drove until I got to my parents' front door. Mom opened it. We hugged. Dad was excited to see me. So was Mom. She had set up a recliner next to his hospital bed in the living room. That's where she had slept every night since he had come home from the hospital. We talked that first night until it was time for Dad to get some rest. Then I went upstairs and slept in my parents' bed. It was weird. My father's life was shrinking. That included a list of places he could and could not go, like his bedroom. He probably would never sleep in it again. The next day, I went to work. My managing editors at IndyStar, bless them, have been extremely supportive throughout this entire process. They encouraged me to go home, to stay as long as necessary, and they were uncommonly kind by preventing to believe my assurances that I would get loads of work done in Texas. That was certainly the lie I told myself on the flight. I'd work remotely while seated across from my dad. It would be easy. Just talk, write, repeat. I think I managed to file all of 2 stories. My ability to concentrate lately has been awful. Unless you hold a pistol to my kneecaps, my thoughts tend to wander. I struggled to write, even when it was quiet while Dad napped, a thing he's been doing more of lately. Even when there weren't multiple phone calls being made to insurance companies, to Social Security, to the military, Dad's getting an honor guard at his funeral after 22 years of service in the Air Force. I just couldn't write. There were other interruptions caused by a steady stream of friends and well-wishers who checked on my parents. I'm not complaining about that, by the way. My mom and dad have been active members of Lions Clubs, the American Red Cross, volunteers at the hospital, the Rainbow Room, and active members of their church. They're blessed to have so many people who care and want to support them through this agonizing chapter of their lives. When I wasn't working, or trying to, Dad and I sat together in front of the TV. We watched his Westerns and his favorite game shows, like Wheel of Fortune and The Price is Right. He seemed to enjoy it when contestants won thousands of dollars in cash. They always looked so happy, like their lives suddenly had new and exciting opportunities that weren't there before. Eventually, he had stopped watching TV. I offered several times to read him whatever books he wanted, but he always declined. That's another thing about my dad you should know. The man doesn't want to be a burden on anyone. Not ever. He thanked me profusely for buying him a cup of his favorite flavored tea, aptly called The Cure. He could also enjoy from the safety of his recliner. But the thought of someone going out of their way to help him, to do literally anything because he's incapable of doing it himself, has always mortified my father. And yet, here we are. Since his diagnosis, my mother has to bathe and feed him, wash his hair, and dress him every day. He's apologized to her several times for having a brain tumor. Members of the East Angelo Lions Club installed a wheelchair ramp outside my parents' apartment before I left. Only a short time ago, Dad enjoyed taking trips with Mom across Texas. He drove, she navigated. They took flights and traveled the world together. Africa, Italy, Great Britain, and Europe. Thanks to that wheelchair ramp, he's thrilled he gets to go outside again and just sit in the sunlight. On my last day in San Angelo, after I closed my work laptop, after I packed my bags and set everything by the door, Mom helped Dad get to his feet. He stood there, unsteady on his legs, as he gripped his walker. Then he threw his arms around me, and we hugged for the last time. In October, just 3 months ago, I was standing outside with my mom and dad, ready to get on the road and drive the 2 days it would take to move to Indiana. The hug he gave me then felt different. His arms had been stronger, the embrace firmer, fiercer. Now he held onto my shoulders, partly to keep his balance, and to say all the things he wanted me to know while he could still say them in person. That I was a good kid. That he was proud of me, and that he loved me very much. "Now, get the hell out of here," he said, a weak smile plastered on his face. "Yes, sir," I replied. Then I grabbed my things and went for the door. In our family, there are three goodbyes. There's one that happens when you announce you're going to leave. There's a second farewell before you exit. And then there's a final goodbye as you're driving away. Mom and Dad always stand outside and they'd wave until you were out of sight. Dad managed the first two goodbyes, but not the last. We said farewell to each other in the living room. And once again, before I walked out of their apartment, but after I set my suitcases in the trunk of the car and turned around, no one was there to see me off. The door was closed. Stupidly enough, I walked back and peered awkwardly through the window. Doing so made me feel a little like Peter Pan, a kid who hadn't but should have grown up. There on the outside, looking in, searching for someone who was no longer there. The window faced the living room where my father's hospital bed and chair sat, but they were both empty. Then I heard my parents talking through the other side of the door. Mom was helping Dad into the bathroom. After that, she had dressed him in his pajamas and put him to bed. I stood there a moment longer, listening as they chatted idly. It took a moment for me to notice my hand was still raised, ready to knock. Wondering if I should knock. Then I realized the moment had passed. I turned around, got into the car, and drove back to Austin. It was a 4-hour trip. I don't remember most of it. My sister was expecting me around 11:30 p.m. that night. She and her husband, Brian, had prepared the couch so I could crash for a few hours before an afternoon flight. I arrived safely. Sarah Marie and I hugged, and then I went to the couch and settled in. It took a long time before I fell asleep. When I awoke the next morning, Brian had already left for work, so my sister and I drank coffee together and reminisced about better times. We talked about Dad, about life, and about grief. It's a hell of a thing, losing a parent. We both knew that on some basic academic level. It's another thing to experience that loss played out over time. No one knows how long the cancer will last, not until it takes our father from us. A hospice nurse who visited Dad while I was there said she thinks he has at least another month, maybe more. Dad asked the nurse what happens when people with brain tumors die. With the polite smile, she told him that death was different for everyone, but wouldn't elaborate. Dad doesn't like taking naps anymore. They make him nervous, despite the nurses who remind him it's important to rest. Like most people experiencing a crisis, this has caused our family to be closer to one another. We talk every day using a video messaging app. Dad brings up the weather in San Angelo. It's one of his favorite subjects. And of course, he tells us he's fine. Everything is fine. It's fantastic. I love you all. Then he mentions all the delicious food he's getting, courtesy of the Lions and other friends who are showering my parents in kindness. And then Dad usually brings up a final request he's made, what he wants all of us to do after he dies. He wants the family, me, Mom, Sarah Marie, Brian, and my daughter Sage, to take a trip to New England, to Maine, the place where Dad spent his summers growing up in Port Clyde. And when we take that trip, Dad wants to come too, in a manner of speaking. We're bringing his ashes along for the ride. Mom already bought the urn. It's aqua blue, like water, with patterns that swirl like an ocean wave. He wants us to eat at his favorite restaurants. He wants us to revisit his favorite places. He wants us all to go to the same sandy beach he loved playing on as a kid, building sandcastles before the tides rolled in and wrecked them. And it's there that he wants his family, his survivors, to build one last sandcastle in his honor. Build when the tides are going out, he said. You gotta wait and build things right so it takes longer for them to wash away. Don't worry, Dad, we will. John Tufts is a former San Angelo Standard Times reporter who now writes for the Indianapolis Star. 70 years later, West Texas Livingston Hearing Aid Center continues family legacy. By Elena Edgen, published in the San Angelo Standard Times, February 3rd. A San Angelo hearing aid store with deep West Texas roots is celebrating a milestone in 2023. It was 1953 when Ollie Livingston opened Livingston Hearing Aids at 1913 19th Street in Lubbock. He was eventually joined in 1976 by Richard Davila Sr., who purchased it in 1986. His son, Richard Davila Jr., still runs Livingston Hearing Aid Center 70 years after the family-owned business began. It still operates in Lubbock, now at 5303 50th Street, along with more than 90 locations across four states, including San Angelo, Abilene, and Wichita Falls. Dr. Hunter Garrett with Livingston Hearing Aid Center also celebrated a milestone with the company, his 10th year in August 2022. Gerhart talked about what the milestones meant to him personally and for Livingston. It feels really amazing to be open to serve and enrich lives through better hearing throughout this many locations, Gerhart said. It's a great feeling to be part of that history. We're really proud of what we've accomplished. Gerhart attributed the company's ongoing success to the community's support and forming long-lasting partnerships with their patients. At Livingston, we don't believe that our job ends when a patient is fitted with hearing aids, he said. It's actually just the beginning. We're going to be there every step of the way for patients. We're going to continue to serve and educate our communities on hearing health and the best way to overcome hearing loss. Gerhardt mentioned that hearing loss affects 1 in 8 people. I've always been a firm believer that hearing is what connects us to people in the world around us, he said. Hearing loss is a big deal, and we are aware that hearing journeys are full of emotions. We're going to continue to be there for people every step of the way as they, or their loved one, deal with hearing loss. According to the Hearing Loss Association of America, 48 million Americans have some degree of hearing loss. HLAA also reported that 2 out of 3 children are born with a detectable level of hearing loss in one or both ears, and 1 in 5 teens experience a degree of hearing loss. We've continued to grow, but we've always kept the future of better hearing in mind, and we're constantly, consistently innovating to achieve that purpose, Gerhardt said. There are still lots of people who believe we believe need our help, and so we don't have any plans to stop our expansions. As of February 3rd, 2023, Livingston is in 8 cities in Arizona, 2 in Colorado, 18 in New Mexico, and 68 in Texas. Now moving to local articles published from SanAngeloLive.com. Shoplifting Grifters High on Weed Indicted for Organized Crime by James Beligny, published March 2nd. 3 individuals were indicted by a Tom Green County grand jury for engaging in organized criminal activity after evidence presented to the grand jury showed them being caught with stolen electronics from 2 Walmart stores. According to court documents, Jesse Kayembe, Kervin Namulimi Kambanda, and Narinessa Renea Jones McDowell were arrested after getting pulled over by a state trooper. The trooper was working a routine patrol in Sterling County on May 6, 2022, at around 1:10 p.m. The trooper observed a black 4-door Chrysler passenger car exceeding the posted speed limit on U.S. Highway 87. The black Chrysler was traveling at a speed of 47 miles per hour in a 35 miles per hour zone. While catching up with the vehicle, the trooper observed a Texas temporary license plate that expired in May 2022, and a traffic stop was conducted. Upon making contact with the 3 occupants, a strong odor of marijuana was emitted from the interior of the suspect vehicle. When asked who had been smoking, the female passenger said everyone was. The 3 occupants were identified as Jones McDowell, Kabanda, and Kayemba. The trooper asked Jones McDowell what the purpose of this trip was, and she stated they were going to a surprise baby shower for her cousin. When she asked for the location of the baby shower, Jones McDowell said she believed it was 2 hours away, but never gave an exact location. The trooper observed evasive mannerisms being displayed, which led him to believe the baby shower story was a fabrication. But Jones McDowell stated that was the reason they got their thing in the back, referring to a large box in the back seat with a diaper genie on it. Jones McDowell gave the trooper an address of Sherwood Way in San Angelo and also stated they were traveling from Houston, but again stated she didn't know the exact location of the baby shower. Then the trooper began speaking with Kayembe. Jones McDowell began actively pacing around, seemed extremely anxious, and would not stay in the location the trooper asked her to stay in. Kayembe was arrested for active warrants out of Fort Bend County. A probable cause search of the vehicle revealed 2 receipts, one from Walmart, located at 610 West 29th Street, and one from 5501 Sherwood Way, both in San Angelo. Both of the receipts contained 1 purchase of 1 diaper pail. 3 diaper genie boxes were discovered in the back seat. Inside the boxes, the trooper located dog medicine and electronics that still had their security devices on them from a store. A diaper genie is a special trash can used for baby diapers. The trooper asked Jones McDowell where the receipts for the items inside the boxes were, and Jones McDowell said the items came from her job, a warehouse for a bookstore. When the trooper approached Jones McDowell to secure her cell phone as evidence, he visibly saw Jones McDowell delete two full text conversations. The trooper also seized Kabanda and Kayambi's cell phones. Jones McDowell was asked again for her place of employment, and she stated FedEx, Ground, and the bookstore, AMG Music Marathons. The trooper could not locate the booker Jones McDowell claimed to work at. While reading Kayambi his Miranda warning, the trooper noticed Kayambi had placed a phone on his video call, and the subject on the other end could see and hear the trooper's conversation and traffic stop. Then Kayambi was asked where they acquired the items, and Kayambi immediately requested an attorney. The black Chrysler was taken to Sterling County Sheriff's Office for further investigation until the investigator could arrive. The investigator arrived at 2:40 p.m. and upon his arrival at the Sterling County Sheriff's Office, observed four diaper genie boxes sitting on a table. Inside the boxes were Frontline dog medicine, USB drives, Nintendo Switch remotes, and calculators. Several of the items were still either in plastic security boxes or still had their anti-theft magnetic devices attached. Jones McDowell began a Mirandized interview with the investigator at around 3 p.m. when the investigator learned the following. Jones McDowell stated that all the items were from her jobs, AMG Bookstore and Movie in Missouri City, Texas, and FedEx Ground in Missouri City, Texas. Jones McDowell stated, "I get them from my manager, and I bring them to the bookstore like he tells me." The items were placed in the diaper genie boxes to make them easier to carry. Jones McDowell stated, "The trip for them was to attend a baby shower for now. A family friend in a city called Merlin or Merling or Berlin, which was apparently an hour from the traffic stop." The investigator stated the only known town that starts with an M and is about an hour away is Midland, to which Jones McDowell agreed was the city they were trying to get to. Jones McDowell was asked who the two males, Kayambi and Kabanda, were, to which Joan McDowell stated Kayambi is her sister's baby daddy and brother-in-law, and Kabanda is Kayambi's cousin. Jones McDowell was asked if she had ever been arrested, to which she replied no, but then changed her answer to once, but she claimed she was released. The investigator later learned Jones McDowell had been arrested four times. The investigator asked Jones McDowell for if she had an invoice for the items, to which she stated no. Then the investigator said he wanted to know where the items came from and told Jones McDowell he didn't believe her story. Jones McDowell expressed numerous criminal stress indicator, which made the investigator believe she was being untruthful and fabricating the story about how the items got into the vehicle. Jones McDowell then stated, "There is nothing I can tell you to make you believe this. I didn't steal anything. You can't prove that I stole anything. I'm literally coming from Houston to Merlington for Merling, whatever it is." The investigator then asked Jones McDowell, "If I go run your work history right now, I'm going to see you work for these two stores?" Jones McDowell stated yes. Then the investigator attempted to locate AMG Bookstore and Music on Highway 6 in Missouri City, Texas, utilizing maps on a mobile phone, and could not locate any such business. Then he attempted to have Jones McDowell locate the business using the same mobile phone, and she could not. A search for AMG Bookstore returned negative results. The investigator asked for her consent to go through Jones McDowell's phone, which she did not allow. Kabanda was interviewed by the investigator about 45 minutes later, and he stated they were going to a baby shower for a family friend. Kabanda was asked if he was related to Kayambi, to which he stated no, contradicting Jones McDowell's statement that they are cousins. When the investigator asked Kabanda for the address he lived at, he stated he wanted to terminate the interview. On May 9, 2022, the investigator went to Walmart, located at 5501 Sherwood Way, and reviewed surveillance footage. In the footage, Jones, McDowell, and Kayembe are seen walking through Walmart, utilizing a diaper genie box to put merchandise in so they could get out of the store without paying for the stolen items. Gabanda is observed pushing a basket around in the general area, acting as a lookout, and all three suspects are constantly on their phone and allegedly in communication with each other while walking around the store. Jones, McDowell, and Gabanda used the self-checkout and only paid for one diaper box, then walked out of the store with two diaper boxes that were filled with merchandise that was not paid for. The items stolen from the store totaled $5,847.85. That same day, the investigator went to Walmart on 29th Street in San Angelo and observed video showing Jones, McDowell, and Kayembe removed a diaper genie from its box and placing it in the aisle. They then used this box to conceal items in order to not pay for them. All three approached the self-checkout and paid for the diaper genie and walked out of the store. All three were also constantly had their cell phones in their hands walking around the store. The total and price of the items stolen from this Walmart totaled $7,258.34. Kayembe was arrested on May 6, 2022 and released the next day, while Jones McDowell posted her bond on May 27th, 2022, and posted his bond on July 13th, 2022. San Angelo Nurse and Children Need Help After Serious Crash, by Matt Trammell. A family in San Angelo is looking for some help after a crash hospitalized a mother and her two children. According to the GoFundMe, on February 22, 2023, a crash involving an 18-wheeler and a white Jeep Grand Cherokee sent a mother and her two children to the hospital. Catherine Rochelle Peeler and her husband, or children rather, were flown to Dallas. While there, Peeler had multiple surgeries to repair two discs in her neck and her foot and ankle, which were crushed. Peeler is a registered nurse who will now be out of work for at least 12 weeks. The family is asking that if anyone could help to donate on the GoFundMe to do so. Fourth poisoned dog will survive, needs forever home, by Matt Trammell. The fourth poisoned dog will survive, confirmed Concho Valley Paws. As previously reported on February 24th, a fourth poisoned dog from the River Bend Estates was located and then taken to the Western Veterinarian Hospital for treatment. New information revealed by Paws Executive Director Jeannie Wilson confirmed that the dog will likely be discharged tomorrow. But the fight for the pup's life is not over. The dog now needs a forever home. If you would like to adopt this dog, contact Concho Valley Paws at 325-656-PETS. Update on biker injured in Knickerbocker crash, by Joe Hyde. Tuesday night, the mood at the crash scene was grim. A motorcyclist hit a black Mazda sedan whose driver was making a left turn on Valley View. In the collision, the biker's helmet was dislodged from his head. Word from the hospital through police at the scene was that the motorcyclist was suffering severe head trauma. The word today from the police was good. I received information that the motorcyclist was discharged this morning from the hospital, said Officer Richard Espinoza, the public affairs officer. According to police, the preliminary investigation revealed that the motorcyclist was northeast bound and the black Mazda sedan was southwest bound at around 9 p.m., Tuesday night, February 28th. Both were on Knickerbocker Road. The driver of the Mazda made a left turn at the light at Knickerbocker and Valley View. Police said the driver failed to yield the right-of-way to the motorcycle. The collision ensued. The force of the collision knocked the helmet off the motorcyclist. Police said at the hospital, emergency room doctors are tackling severe head injuries of the motorcyclist. Police learned that the injuries were life-threatening. Police would only say that the motorcyclist was a male and a day later, police said he was released from the hospital. San Angelo Museum of Fine Arts damaged roof being replaced by James Belligny, published March 1st. The San Angelo Museum of Fine Arts will be getting a major roof upgrade that will take a couple of months. According to the museum's Facebook page, the museum will be closed until June 1st, 2023. The reason why the museum is going to be getting a new roof is thanks to an insurance settlement. The copper roof was damaged in a hailstorm in 2020. Although the museum is closed, it will still be hosting art exhibits at Fort Concho and the Quartermaster's Gallery at the other end of the fort. That means all exhibits and programs will go on as regularly scheduled. Concho Valley Public Defender's Office picks up major win with not guilty jury verdict by Matt Trammell, published March 1st. A San Angelo man facing 20 years in prison walked away a free man thanks to the new Concho Valley Public Defender's Office. According to court documents, on February 28th, Joe Gutierrez, 37, of San Angelo, was found not guilty of evading arrest with a previous conviction and possession of a controlled substance. The state was represented by Jensen Martinez and Richard Villarreal, while Gutierrez was represented by Ted Winsky and Joe Stevens of the Concho Valley Public Defender's Office. Prior to lunch, the jury saw evidence that included the alleged meth, the dash cam footage from the officer's car, and multiple other photographs. They also heard from a number of witnesses throughout the day, including SAPD officers, DPS forensic scientists, and others. The jury began deliberating at 5:06 p.m. and finished at 9:51 p.m. After hearing all the evidence and deliberating well into the night, the jury came back with the correct verdict, not guilty on both counts, stated Chief Public Defender Chief Joe Stevens. Our office, new as it is, takes great pride in fighting for the lives and dignity of the people we represent. Yesterday's result was just one. This is the first major win in Tom Green County by the Concho Valley Public Defender's Office, which was approved by the Tom Green County Commissioners in July 2021. Although this is its first jury trial win in Tom Green County, the Public Defender's Office has earned a not guilty verdict in Sterling County as well. San Angelo ISD Board votes to combine beloved elementary schools by Matt Trammell, published February 28th. The San Angelo ISD School Board on Monday night finalized the combining of multiple elementary schools during its regular meeting. Two elementary schools will close. The way the school board finalized the closures was by setting new boundary lines for students attending elementary schools in North and West San Angelo. The schools affected are Alta Loma Elementary, Fannin Elementary, Austin Elementary, and McGill Elementary. After a 6-1 vote, the board approved to combine Alta Loma and Fannin, combine Austin and McGill, and shut down Alta Loma and Austin. Two other schools that survived the cut, they were San Jacinto and Reagan Elementary. It was proposed that the two schools be combined at Reagan and San Jacinto be turned into an early childhood center. The board voted 2-5 against that plan. These combinations will not take place until the 2024-25 school year. Update: Children ejected in rollover crash on Houston Heart by James Belligny, published February 28th. Two children were ejected in the single vehicle rollover crash Monday afternoon that shut down part of the Houston Heart Expressway. According to San Angelo Police Department Public Information Officer Richard Espinoza, Tuesday afternoon, officers were dispatched to the 300 block of East Houston Heart Expressway eastbound in reference to a single vehicle rollover accident. Officers arrived on scene and learned that an extended cab Ford Ranger pickup had rolled over into the median and struck the guard wire. The occupants of the vehicle were an adult male driver, an adult female front right passenger, and that there were two young children. possibly aged 10 and 6 years of age, located behind the front driver and passenger. Officers said that both children were ejected from the vehicle and that the female adult passenger was also partially ejected. The adult male driver was able to speak with officers, and he advised that he lost control after a tire had blown out on his vehicle. Multiple bystanders assisted with providing first aid to the injured children, as well as the female passenger, prior to San Angelo Fire Department medics arriving on scene. All four occupants of the vehicle were transported to Shannon Medical Center via the SAFD ambulances for medical treatment. There was no child safety seat present for the younger child, and it was unknown if either of the children or the adult female were properly restrained with safety belts. It is unknown if any citations are being issued at this time, as the investigation is still ongoing. The accident is being investigated by SAPD's Motors Division, and all of the occupants were listed to have non-life-threatening injuries. The Tom Green County Sheriff's Office assisted with directing traffic on scene as well. Woman indicted in apartment complex drowning death of toddler, by James Beligny, published February 27th. A San Angelo woman has been indicted for manslaughter after a toddler drowned at an area apartment complex last June. Selena Bannon, 27, had been indicted by a Tom Green County grand jury for manslaughter of a 4-year-old toddler. According to the indictment, on June 9, 2022, Bannon allegedly undid a strap on the life vest worn by the toddler and failed to properly supervise him. According to the San Angelo Police Department, on June 9, 2022, at around 5:30 p.m., police were dispatched to the 3300 block of North Bryant Boulevard, or the Resort at Riverside, for a possible drowning. Once on scene, police discovered a 4-year-old boy unconscious. CPR was immediately performed on the child, and when paramedics arrived on scene, took the child to Shannon Medical Center, where the toddler was pronounced dead. The child was later identified through GoFundMe as Rodolfo Mercado IV. The indictment did not specify if Bannon is related to the child in any way. Mysterious Helicopter Circles Over San Angelo, by Joe Hyde, published February 25th. Numerous readers have inquired about a helicopter that was circling multiple times around San Angelo for hours. The west side of San Angelo sits underneath the final approach path for Mathis Field's primary runway 18. However, winds have been favoring northerly departures and landings on runway 36. The helicopter was witnessed hovering around various locations Friday night from around 9:30 p.m. until 10:30 p.m. It reappeared Saturday afternoon. We spotted it over the Bentwood Country Club Estates a few moments ago. Mathis Field's tower confirmed that the helicopter is carrying a U.S. Customs and Border Patrol call sign, but other than deconflicting the helicopter's flight path with outbound traffic from the airport, they are not aware of what its mission is. The speculation is that the helicopter is practicing with a sensor that apparently works in the daylight or nighttime. We reached out to our contacts at the CBP to confirm or deny. Deadly rabbit bleeding eye disease spreads into the Texas Hill Country, by Yantis Green, published February 25th. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, with the help of the National Wildlife Health Center, has detected the eastward expansion of rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus 2, RHDV2, in the state. First found in dead rabbits in El Paso, Terrell, Brewster, and Reeves counties, RHDV2 cases have expanded to Gillespie County. The detection in Gillespie County represents the first wild case of RHDV2 in the Hill Country. TPWD continues to receive and respond to mortality events in wild rabbits and hares across the state. If you notice sick or dead wild rabbits, contact a local TPWD wildlife biologist. Learn more about RHDV2 and wild rabbits on the RHDV page of the TPWD website. Rabbit hemorrhagic disease, RHD, is a highly contagious viral disease that can affect both domestic and wild rabbit species including hares, jackrabbits, and cottontails. This disease is nearly always fatal and affects rabbits of all ages. The viral agent, rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus, RHDV, is a calivirus with two strains, RHDV1 and RHDV2, both being reported in North America in recent years. RHDV appears only to affect rabbit species, lagomorphs. It is not known to affect humans, livestock, or pets. However, pets should not be allowed to consume dead animal carcasses. Often the only clinical sign is sudden death. In less acute cases, clinical signs in rabbits have included dullness, apathy, not eating, bleeding from the nose and eyes, or watery, congested eyes. Some may also exhibit neurological signs such as incoordination, excitement, or seizure-like episodes. The highly contagious disease spreads between rabbits easily through direct contact with infected rabbits or carcasses, in addition to contaminated meat, fur, food, water, insects, or materials and objects they may encounter. RHDV2 is resistant to desiccation and can persist in the environment for a very long time. These factors make disease control efforts extremely challenging once it is in wild rabbit populations. Domestic rabbit owners who have questions about RHDV2 or observe sudden death in their rabbits should contact their private veterinarian. Private veterinarians are requested to contact the USDA APHIS or the Texas Animal Health Commission, TAHC, to report any suspected cases at 800-550-8242. Rabbit owners or breeders should practice biosecurity on their farms and in their homes. Report all unusual mass morbidity, sickness, or mortality, deaths, events to the THHC. Find more information about RHDV on the U.S. Department of Agriculture Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service fact sheet.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.